Good afternoon. I'll call the Senate Committee on Commerce to order. Today we have a couple of bills up for public hearing only. I don't believe we have any work session, meaning no committee bills for possible introduction. If we do, we'll take those up at a later time this afternoon. The first public hearing that we have scheduled for today is Senate Bill 361. So I will go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 361 and ask Ms. Braun to give us an overview of 361.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 361 adds inspectors to the definition of workers who must be paid a prevailing wage on public works projects. It has no revenue impact, and it may have a fiscal impact, but we don't have a statement issued yet.
All right, thank you. We have two people that are currently signed up for Senate Bill 361, Raymond Steele, and let's go ahead and just have Raymond, if you'd be willing to come up. We have someone in opposition. Instead of bringing you both up together, we'll just start off with those four. Mr. Steele? And if you will be so kind to identify yourself for the record, and then go ahead and give us your testimony.
I'm Raymond Steele. I work for Mays Testing Engineers. I'm actually the one that approached Senator Morissette and Representative Wayne Scott about this bill proposal. Essentially, I've been a working special inspector in the state of Oregon for 13 years. I believe that my peer group and I need to be represented financially according to the work that's going on and the other trades that are out there. This all started with a question several years ago, why don't we as inspectors receive a prevailing wage? And the answer that I got was you have to ask the Bureau of Labor and Industry. Their response was, You're classified as professionals, not tradespeople. And I said, well, how do we fix that? And they said, you change the law.
Yeah. And that's why you're here.
That's why I'm here.
All right. So why don't you give us a little bit more insight, Mr. Steele, as to the type of work you do and what you're seeking. I understand wanting to have what I would call a reclassification to put individuals such as yourself into a classification that would allow for prevailing wages to be used and not be identified as a professional?
Essentially, we share the same hazards as the trades that we inspect. We share the same environmental impacts that the trades, as far as walking steel, dealing with concrete, doing our inspections hand in hand with people that are actually building the building. We look at ourselves, I guess, as the watchdogs of the industry to make sure that what the design professional asks for, he gets, and what the client or the developer is wanting and paying for, he gets, so that we don't have a high liability to the public. I didn't really come here with a written testimony. I figured if you had some questions, I could answer them. The reality of my world is that this is the right thing to do. It's been a long time in coming. Myself, I work for probably one of the finest testing firms in the Northwest, but I can't afford to do a lot of things, even though, say, medically, I'm severe asthmatic. I have health insurance through the company. I have to pay for my wife and child. But in order to sustain the maintenance drugs that keep me from going into respiratory arrest, I have to use the VA because I'm a veteran with service-connected disabilities. Or I can't afford those drugs through the company. And it's the same with the peers that I work with. We all essentially work paycheck to paycheck. There's no retirement like in the trades where they're paid X amount of dollars for every hour that they work. The risks that we take are the same, even greater, because we're not necessarily liked on a job all the time, because we are telling somebody to just because you've been doing it for 30 years that way doesn't make it right. So we're at risk in a lot of ways, but I think that we honestly should have this. Okay. It's a good thing.
Right. Mr. Still, I'm going to ask you a couple other questions and maybe give myself some clarity. From what the beginning of your testimony, you stated that you work, it sounds like, for a private employer who is contracted to do oversight inspection of buildings or, let's say, new developments or remodels, whatever it may be. Can you give us
yes.
a little bit more?
Yes, sir. I'm a steel inspector. I come from a welding and ironworking background. I was reeducated. I have a degree in metallurgy, materials testing, and welding technology with the specific intent of becoming an inspector to go forward in this field. We do bridges. We do hospitals. We do high schools. We do office buildings, private sector. We work both sides of the publicly funded money and the privately funded money. The group that's included in this bill are what are called special inspectors, kind of like in the healthcare profession. You have your cardiothoracic specialist or your neuro specialist. We specialize in certain areas in the construction trades that are outside the realms of what the governing body supplies. We have to be educated. We have to be skilled. We have to have a continuing education in order to renew our credentials every 3 years. These cost money, but we have to have them in order to stay proficient in our trade. We deal with concrete, masonry, reinforced concrete, steel, soils, and those aspects of the construction industry. Did I answer your question?
You did. Let me ask if there's any questions from the panel. Assemblyman Monroe.
Yeah, what percentage of your work is done, your inspection work is done on public works projects, and what percentage is done on private construction, which would not be covered by this bill?
I honestly can only guess at that, and I would say probably 25% of what I do is prevailing wage type work. Okay. The rest is private money.
Okay.
The only job that I know of that I worked on this last year that was truly involved with public funding was the OHSU tram. And I did steel inspection and ultrasonic testing and bolting and stuff on that.
And I'd like to follow up on that. When you say prevailing wage work, you're talking about work that is in the public sector that as compared to something that's exclusively private?
My interpretation of prevailing wage is government sponsored, whether it's city, state, or federal level,
right?
Publicly funded with bonds or whatever, you know. Private sector is what they're doing on the waterfront downtown. The money's coming from all the different trade unions, and they got together with a developer, and now they're building these, which allows the unions to come in and work the jobs at their collective bargaining rate. Those are not, in my mind, prevailing wage-type jobs,
right,
even though they are making pretty decent money. My idea of prevailing wage is a bridge or a hospital or the tram, stuff like that. That's
okay.
My interpretation.
Yes.
Additional question. Since you're not now covered, if this bill passes, the Department of Labor and Industries is going to have to establish what the prevailing wage is for your type of work.
Yes, sir.
Do you believe that you work for a major firm? Is your compensation for the work you do about the average for the industry?
At this point in time right now?
Yes.
For Oregon, yeah. I have been down working for the Division of State Architecture in California, which only works public works. And for what I do here, I made twice as much down there.
Yeah, but prevailing wage, when the Department of Labor and Industry sets the prevailing wage for your type of work, they would look to this area, Oregon or the Pacific Northwest, for actuarials, I would think.
When I read the content of the bill, it basically said, yes, they would look at similar or like agencies. They would, if not be able to establish with those, they would go outside the state to similar and like agencies or work through collective bargaining or something like that. I understand that. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
So I have one other question that's just minor. I'm not sure if I'm following the concept. When your company is hired to do an inspection, it sounds like it could be done at the request of a public body or a private entity?
Yes, that's exactly true. Jobs are submitted for proposal, for bids, and we bid like anybody else, like an erection company or a fabrication facility or a general contractor or anything like that. We do go through the same process. We have to put out a bid to whether it's a publicly funded or a private sector job.
And does the is there some type of, let's say, official public sign-off on the construction of a site? In other words, I'm trying to figure out if your company is providing a service that would be required to be done at a public entity level, but for them not having those individuals, they're going out and contracting for your company's services. In other words, it would seem to me that if a skyscraper is being built, that we would want to make certain that it's being built to compliance to whatever the standards are, that it's safe for occupancy, and not only what's going on the walls, but the structure itself, because you're basically setting the framework, no pun intended, as to what's actually going to be the structure?
Yes. In all reality, I might be losing what you're asking, but yes, we deal with all aspects of the building of the building, from the footings to the penthouse.
Are there other governmental employees or someone that works? I'm going to use the example of something in Portland where you might see a skyscraper being built. Is there someone like from the city inspectors that come out and look at the footings or look at how the steel is actually being put there, or is that something that your company contracts?
I am a deputy licensed city special inspector for the city of Portland.
Okay.
And basically they look to us to do that. They do have special inspectors that work on some of their public works. A peer of mine works for the city of Portland now as a special inspector, and he basically deals with their water projects and Bull Run Reservoir and stuff like that. But they also subcontract special inspectors to work for them for the city.
Okay. All right, I just want to make sure I understand exactly how you fit into this process that is overseeing or has some type of certifications or licenses or permits that are being approved. Any other questions from the panel?
Yes.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good afternoon. I may have missed it, but have we established how many workers in this category, inspectors, would be affected by this?
With the research that I was able to do, we as special inspectors in the state of Oregon, from what I understand, are supposed to be registered with the Oregon Association of Building Officials, the OBOA. And when I looked at the roster for the OBOA 2 weeks ago, there was 111 licensed special inspectors on the list. Of those 111, roughly 20 of them are working administrative or managerial positions, but they're still licensed. So for the whole state of Oregon, we're looking at about 80 special inspectors. of those 80 special inspectors, probably I would say 60 of them work in the city of Portland. Of the 80 special inspectors that are out there, probably 85% of them are 45 years and older, due to retire as early as we possibly can. I don't see myself retiring until I'm 73, because there just isn't a retirement program unless we go with a 401k. What this bill will hopefully do, if it does pass, is maybe make Oregon a place where inspectors want to come back to, because we're losing a lot to California and Nevada that are paying prevailing wage. They do have unions down there for inspectors through the operating engineers, so that there's no conflict with the other trades. And we're losing people for that reason. Hopefully, if this prevailing wage bill passes, we can entice young people to take an interest in becoming licensed and work in the field, or maybe bring some outside people in, because our numbers are dwindling.
Thank you.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if you know the answer to this, but if they don't hire someone like yourself as a contractor, I guess for lack of a better term to use, than the city of Portland, Multnomah County, whoever it is, because the public entity, I think, is charged with inspecting these projects. So that they either hire you as a contract employee, or they have to provide a public employee to do the job, is that correct?
Depending on the governing body, like the city of Portland, for instance, they require that any special inspector that works within the city confines is attached and working for an approved testing lab for the city by the city building officials. Or you can't work in the city of Portland. So essentially, yeah, I can go work for the Corps of Engineers as a contract employee, but if I'm going to do what I do in the city of Portland, I have to work for a testing lab that there's a list of them that are approved by the city that general contractors and developers and engineers can draw from to go to work. Did that answer your question?
I'm not sure.
Me neither.
All right, any other questions?
No, not now.
Okay, Mr. Steele, thank you very much for coming forward. I do want to just put on the record, we have received a letter from House Republican Leader Wayne Scott in support of this bill. That is part of the record, and I just want to let Mr. Steele know that we have received something from him.
I've seen those. There's a gentleman behind me that brought to my attention that it's of the understanding of the people that he represents, that his inspectors are involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
And the intent of the bill that I asked to be written should be dealing exclusively and only with special inspectors under the international code and the Oregon Building Code, Chapter 17, classified special inspectors.
Okay, well, I think you may be pointing to Mr. Long, and we'll give Mr. Long an opportunity to come up and speak if he wants to put something on the record. All right, I thank you, Mr. Steele. The next person we have on the sign-up sheet is John Charles. Mr. Charles, why don't you come on up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles, president of Cascade Policy Institute, a research center in Portland, and we're primarily a civil liberties organization, and so I would have longer remarks to say if you were considering repealing prevailing wage entirely, but that's not the subject of the bill, so I'll save that speech for another time. But just to say that the entire purpose of prevailing wage comes from an era in this country that we should not be proud of. It's discriminatory in its effect. And that's why I oppose this bill, because it makes a bad situation worse. I don't think we should be looking to expand it. We should be looking to shrink it. I have a little commentary for you, the short version as well as the long version, if you're really gluttons for punishment and want to read all that and look at all the footnotes. But in essence, the fundamental problem, of course, is that we believe people should be have a fundamental right to sell their labor on the market at whatever wage they mutually agree to with someone else. And secondarily, when the government intervenes through what's called the prevailing wage process, of course, there is no way for the government to know what a prevailing wage is. And you sort of try to draw that out of the previous witness. Are you paid at the average, above average, below average? Well, if someone comes intervenes from the outside and they set a prevailing wage, which is an artificial construct, above what the market would bear, then that money has to be reallocated from someone. Someone else lower on the scale is going to lose a job. There's only a limited amount of capital. So you've created harm for someone, but you've benefited someone else. If the prevailing wage is set at lower than what your market is worth, your market wage is worth, then obviously you're worse off. If the prevailing wage turns out to be exactly what the market wage is, then the process was redundant and was useless, except that you've created a lot more paperwork. And when I've talked to contractors who are subject to prevailing wage, it's the paperwork part of it that is one of the most onerous parts. So I just think if this was such a great idea, you would expand it to the private sector. And if you want to have a bill to do that, I'm sure you'd have lots of testimony about that. But we don't do it in the private sector because it's not a good idea. It essentially helps create a cartel, and people who are excluded from the cartel in the labor market or any other market are hurt. And so I just think that although this is a tiny little incremental step, it's an incremental step in the wrong direction. I suggest that the bill should just be tabled, and that at some point, if you really want to have a worthwhile debate, you consider, in fact, repealing a law that was bad at the time it was enacted and is still bad.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, Senator Avakian?
I'm curious if your theory behind that applies to the government. The government's intervention in free market setting of wages in any respect, such as would it also apply to the minimum wage, and should the government not be setting a minimum wage, or does it apply only to our setting of wages with regard to government projects versus private ones?
Mr. Chair, Senator Avakian, your point is well taken. And yes, we do believe that the minimum wage law itself is dysfunctional. It causes unemployment among those least able to fend for themselves, the lowest skilled, the least experienced, and that there is no way for a government body to know what is the appropriate minimum wage. And if they actually knew that and there were no side effects, then we should set the minimum wage at $100 an hour and we'd all be rich. So let's just do that.
Any other questions, Senator?
No.
Mr. Charles, I guess I only had one question. What we've heard from this from Mr. Still, who was our previous witness, I get the impression that the government has established certain criteria as to what we expect for performance, or let's say expectations as to a compliance of a building structure and being able to withstand certain thresholds to being safe for people. And if they had someone that was on the payroll of the city, state, whatever governmental agency that may be overseeing it, they'd be paid at whatever rate that might be. And it appears that what Mr. Still is asking for is that they would be able to receive comparable pay for a comparable work. Does the Institute have a position on whether that would be something that would be reasonable, or do you take the position that maybe we shouldn't have any? I guess it would be public employees and everything should just be contracted out.
Mr. Chairman, my testimony is not a comment on the value of public employees per se. It's a comment on the impossibility of knowing, of any outside body knowing in a particular context what is the appropriate wage. Now, certainly appropriate for the government to have safety standards, and as someone who goes in high rises and rides elevators, I like to think that someone inspected that work. But the nature of the issue of how compensation is set, to me, is a matter of adults, consenting adults, agreeing to a compensation package. And if you don't agree with the package offered, you should decline it and go somewhere else. And only the market at one point in time knows what is the appropriate level. And General Accounting Office at the federal level has issued numerous reports over periods of decades noting the impossibility of this, and that there's always this issue of, well, what is the prevailing wage? It seems to be this ephemeral thing that people can't find.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much. I always enjoy having some conversations on civil liberty issues. I have a number of friends who are, and when we talk about safety and stuff like that, we all want to make sure we're safe, and the structures are, in this case, are safe, but maybe not, let's say, reaching the threshold of equal pay in this particular situation. We'd let the market bear what it is, but I would seem to me in this particular case, if you had someone that said, well, we'll do the inspections, and you kind of sometimes maybe get what you pay for, maybe the type of inspection you get for a bottom dollar may not be as thorough and, let's say, as thorough as you would want them to be to make certain that they've actually checked those bolts, that they are, in fact, set to code.
Mr. Chairman, if that's the concern, then it would be a good idea to expand prevailing wage to all sectors of the economy.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. Any other questions? Mr. Charles, thank you for being here today.
Thank you, sir. Amendment.
And let's see. Mr. Long, I'm going to give you an opportunity if you would like to come up and put anything on the record based on Mr. Steele's comments.
Wouldn't fit.
No, you're right back on it. You're locked out by her.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mark Long, I'm the Administrator of State Building Codes for a division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. What I'd like to do is just kind of clarify what we're talking about. I think there might be some confusion about inspectors, the private side versus the government side. And first and foremost, the bill as written, I don't believe in listening to Mr. Steele that it was his intent, folds in the government inspectors that work for state government doing building inspections and local government, cities, counties, et cetera, that perform building code inspections and would establish a prevailing wage rate for inspectors who worked on or inspected a public project. That, for the government, would be problematic. As you can imagine, we have collective bargaining laws. We have established pay rates for our employees, and any kind of difference on a project-by-project basis is problematic, both mechanically, but I think it gets into collective bargaining issues as well. I don't believe that's the intent of Mr. Steele, as we spoke before the hearing, and so I think we probably do need some amendments to clarify that if the bill's going to go forward.
All right.
Okay, and my overview document shows you, hopefully quickly, why we believe that we're tied in, because we referenced two particular pieces of statute. 455 is the one that I'm mostly concerned about, because that's the statute that references government inspectors, folks that work for me, and the cities and counties. And I know that the cities and counties equally are concerned. However, there's another bill in another committee on prevailing wage that they're prevailing rates that they're looking at right now. If you'd like, I could help clarify the differences between these different kinds of inspectors. They're about, you know, the word inspector means something different to everybody. And Mr. Steele is what's called a special inspector. You have the government inspectors. You have third-party inspectors. Then, of course, you have the home inspectors, which were brought into this under the CCD statute 701-005. All those different types of inspectors do different things. Under Mr. Steele's company, they work directly for the owner. They're an owner's representative to look out for the owner's interest in construction, and the building code requires them to look at particular pieces where the local government inspector can't be there during the welding of steel, during the pouring of some of the concrete, and significant areas. They are private inspectors that are owner's representative. They are not inspectors that are doing work on behalf of the municipalities when there's a workflow issue where you maybe contract out the job because you're a city or county and you're having difficulty meeting workflow. Those are what we call third-party inspectors. I also regulate those individuals. We license those through building codes. They're included under the 455 definition. So multiple different kinds of inspectors. I hope I haven't complicated this. What Mr. Steele is trying to do, if it's limited to those private special inspectors who are the owner's agent, the legislature wants to move that forward, so be it. If it includes the government inspectors, then we would have a concern.
Questions? I do. Thank you, Ms. Long, for actually some clarification there, because what I heard in your testimony was maybe not what I understood Mr. Steele was attempting to explain to me, and that is that there is a difference between a special inspector and a third-party inspector,
mm-hmm.
and what I think I understand is that from your testimony is that the special inspector is actually someone that's hired by the employer, the private entity that's actually constructing the building. They're there on the job site on a daily basis, monitoring the work that's being done by their employees or subs or whoever's doing the welding, et cetera, walking the lines and all that, as compared to a third-party inspector. If you had a city such as Portland, and not saying that they don't have the inspectors that would be doing these tests, for code compliance, those third-party inspectors could be hired or retained by Portland, if that was the entity, to actually carry out and make certain that whatever is being built meets code.
Meets the government requirements for life safety.
Okay.
The government can carry out its responsibilities to make sure that the code is carried out through its own staff or through these third-party inspectors
okay.
that we license and are actually referenced in this 455-715. Then again, you have the home inspectors under CCB, which for the finance, you know, when you sell a home and there's those private home inspectors, that sometimes gets confused. And then you have special inspectors, which, again, are required by code for certain things, but are hired by the owner's agent. What Portland will do and other cities will do will recognize or license those entities and only allow certain special inspection organizations that meet standards. You heard reference to the OBOA list that meet standards to be recognized as that owner's agent for a particular project.
Okay.
And
then if someone was actually trying to, let's say, run this through and have BOLI set the prevailing rate, what I'm hearing is that basically the third-party inspector, you might try to get a comparable pay for what the government inspector may find, and then for a prevailing wage in the sense of for a special inspector, they may either go with that same type of route, looking at what type of work they do, or if they're in the same hazardous situation as the actual builders, the people that are working the job site, maybe trying to figure out what might be out in the market for that type of service?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Again, just to be clear, and I don't believe it's the intent of the proposer of the bill, as long as the government inspectors aren't part of that or the ones that we regulate them, then the rest of it's a public policy decision for the legislature.
All right. Is there any other questions for Mr. Long? Thank you very much for coming up and giving us the clarification. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 361? Not seeing any, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 361. And we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 342. And Ms. Braun, before you jump up and run away from us,
sorry,
if you could give us the overview for Senate Bill 342.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 342 allows a registered nurse to work as a full-time nursing instructor for a public employer without the loss of the public employee retirement benefits. It has no revenue impact and may have a fiscal impact, but we don't have a statement yet. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. We have two people that are signed up, both in the position of being proponents for the bill. So Susan King and I believe it's Sandy Theus.
Nice.
If you two would be so kind to come on up.
And excuse me, Mr. Chair, Senator Montes Anderson wants to testify on this bill, too, so
okay.
I will make sure she's notified.
Why don't we go and get her, and we'll have her testify after we have the opening from here. Mr. Dempsey, are you here just for support, or did you want to come up and be grilled? I'd like to have answer any questions. Okay, just wanted to make sure.
Get him up here. Come on.
Ms. King, I'm not sure who wants to start off, but
go ahead.
It makes a difference. You're first on the list.
Good afternoon, Senator Prezansky and members of the committee. My name is Susan King. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Nurses Association. Speaking today in support of Senate Bill 342, this is one of three proposals that this legislative body will see. There is a House version that is a bit broader than this, and then there will be a general nursing workforce shortage bill that will include a similar provision related to all registered nurses. But this particular bill, as my colleague Sandy Theus will attest to, deals with one particular aspect of the nursing shortage that is critical for for our state. The average age of nursing faculty we know is in approximately 55 to 60 age range, which means that their retirement, the wave of retirement, has already begun. We can't hope to solve the nursing shortage that we're currently facing and we will be facing on into the future unless we have an adequate supply of nursing faculty to educate new professionals. This particular bill would allow nurses with years of experience and knowledge to retire under the public employee retirement system and then continue to practice as nursing faculty in one of many of our public nursing schools, thus retaining their knowledge and experience in the public system. Currently, those individuals could leave a public employer and go to a private employer and work as much as they like. Now they're limited to 1,040 hours or less, which is a severe detriment to the future supply of nursing faculty. And I'm going to stop and yield to my colleague, Senator Ron Sanderson.
Senator, I know that you're on a busy schedule, so if you want to give your testimony now, or if you have time to spend with us, we'll love to have you join us for as long as you can.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Senator Lori Monas Anderson, for the record. I represent District 25, which is Fairview, Gresham, Troutdale, and Wood Village. And I'm here to talk about Senate Bill 342, and I'm not sure what my esteemed colleague next to me, fellow nurse, has said, but Oregon is facing a serious shortage of qualified nursing faculty, and that's particularly in the rural areas and the community colleges. According to the Oregon Center for Nursing, their report stated that Oregon's nursing community has really stepped up to meet the demand for an increased educational nursing capacity, but truly is still there's a severe lack of available qualified faculty to each nursing student. By 2010, according to the report, 65% of the current full-time faculty positions will be vacated due to retirement, and that is overwhelming, and I would have Ms. King please verify that, because when I saw that statistic, it's pretty incredible. At the same time that the faculty is retiring, the need for registered nurses in Oregon continues to grow at a very increased demand. All across the nation, states are faced with similar statistics. The most shocking part I think about this is that schools are turning away up to almost 16,000 qualified nursing applicants due to insufficient numbers of qualified faculty members. So if Oregon's really properly going to sustain the level of registered nurses to cope with the growing demand of health care, the legislature really must take an active role in helping attract and keep qualified faculty. So Senate Bill 342 would amend the current PERS law to allow for nurses who are currently retired under the PERS system to be employed full-time by public employers as nursing instructors without the loss of their retirement benefits. Currently, the maximum hours, and I think I heard Ms. King say, they can work up to 1,040 hours. In amending the statute, this legislature would allow the retired nurses with a full career of experience to teach new nurses at a time when Oregon really needs faculty with both experience and education. So, with 65% of the nursing faculty retiring in the next 3 to 5 years, limiting retired nurses to teach will truly hurt Oregon's healthcare profession. There is definitely a serious demand for experienced nurses, nursing faculty, and the demand for nurses is too great to not allow retired nurses to fill the faculty gap and rejuvenate Oregon's nursing. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for the senator? Thank you. If you need to leave, thank
I'll
you for being
for a little bit.
Wonderful. Ms. King, if you'd like to go ahead and just identify yourself again for the record and complete your testimony, that'd be great.
Susan King, for the record, I think the senator has echoed my concern that, and as near as we can tell in terms of verifying the percentage of faculty that retire, I think what we're looking at is the worst-case scenario. in terms of the numbers that might retire. Now, predicting anyone's retirement is rather esoteric in its construct, but we do know if you just look at simply the average age of nursing faculty, you can see that we are headed for a very serious shortage in a very short period of time if people retire when people typically do. So I would just, again, lend my support to this bill as one of a package of bills that you will ultimately see and conclude. Thank you.
Ms. Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Sandy Tice, and I'm interim dean for the OHSU School of Nursing. And I also speak in favor of this bill. I'll try not to repeat what's already been mentioned. But we are the ones who are definitely feeling the shortage of faculty. To kind of put this into some context, about 4 years ago, the PERS guidelines were changed so that it was advantageous for faculty to retire at that time. Had they continued to work, their benefits would have declined unless they had worked another 4 years. Many made the decision to retire then, many years before they really should have, so to speak. Many nursing faculty across the state in both associate degree and baccalaureate nursing programs took advantage of this opportunity. OHSU has hired several of these people to teach, but as has been mentioned, at about 49% or 0.49 FTE. Some of them, not all, but some of them would like to teach more. And as you heard, they are restricted by PERS guidelines from doing so. Just last week, I had a conversation with a nurse, advanced practice nurse, who works for Multnomah County, so he's therefore part of PERS. And he thought it would be wonderful to retire from his position there and to come and teach for OHSU, and I thought it would be great. Part of the reason why it would be advantageous to retire and then continue to work as a faculty member would be that you would be able to keep the retirement benefits going. We know now that at OHSU that a faculty member makes about $30,000 less a year than an equivalent advanced practice nurse who is working in OHSU hospitals. That's significant. And people don't want to quit being advanced practice nurses and come and teach because of that change in salary. That's another major problem that we have that we need to deal with. This bill won't necessarily deal with that. But the nurse could then be maintaining retirement benefits and then continue and maybe be willing to work at the reduced salary. One of the things I think is interesting related to the nursing shortage, of course, is that we are unable to admit nationwide about 150,000 qualified nurses. It's not all because of the faculty shortage, but that's a big reason. 74% of schools nationwide identify the faculty shortage as a reason for not accepting students. We have among the nursing faculty the same aging problem that everybody else has. We're getting older, and the average age is increasing. For a master's prepared faculty, it's about 54. I have some little different figures about Oregon. The average age of retirement for faculty members in Oregon is 62.5. In Oregon, we're expecting about 15% of community college faculty and about 23% of baccalaureate faculty are expected to retire within the next 5 years. So by 2010, there'll be an estimated 65 faculty positions that'll be vacant in Oregon simply due to retirements. So in order to increase students, we do need more faculty. Actually, the State Board of Nursing is currently, in their current survey, they're trying to get a better sense now of what the retirements will be in faculty in the next few years. We've we at OHSU have taken advantage of some programs to increase the number of faculty, and I can speak of those if you wish. We also, one of our legislative initiatives for OHSU is the development of a master's program in nursing education with a concentration in community or gerontology that would also help that. That's a different bill than this. But I just want you to know that we're doing some other things that I think will be helpful. We need to take advantage of every program that we can find, but we do need your assistance with this and giving us the ability to rehire our experienced faculty and nurses in the practice area who retire and would like to come back and teach for us would greatly enhance our ability to increase the number of nursing students. And I'd be happy to answer questions if you have any.
Senator Monroe?
Do you have nursing faculty now that are retired that teach half-time?
Yes, Senator Monroe, we do. We have, let's see, at OHSU we probably have 10 to 15 of those types of people who have retired and have come back and are teaching up to half-time for us.
Okay.
And very successfully. I mean, they have years and years of experience, so they're excellent faculty.
I know, of course, I'm an educator, uh-huh. and I know a lot of teachers and administrators that go on retirement and still continue to work up to their 1,040 hours or
right.
whatever they're allowed.
Right. And some would prefer to keep it at that, but there are others that I know of for sure who would like to increase that number, and they aren't able to do it.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Tice, I'm going to kind of, let's say, get outside the box of what we have here. We have individuals, it sounds like, that are still working, haven't retired. Is there things that we could be doing to, let's say, enhance the opportunity to retain them in the current employment without them retiring and then seeking to be gainfully employed under this type of measure?
Senator Prozanski, I think... some things that we're trying to do are in the area of faculty development, enhancing infrastructure so that it's not so difficult for them to teach. Some of the initiatives that OHSU is looking at would do that. This bill wouldn't necessarily do that. I mean, we would like to keep people in the workplace as long as possible also. But the reality is that, you know, they may choose to retire for lots of reasons. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, I know we have this crisis that we can project.
Right.
And it's better to be prepared for it. And what can we do to get those who already left the profession back into it,
right.
if they're willing to and understanding there's limitations, as we know, 1,040 hours.
Right.
Maybe close to 6 months, but that's about it.
It's about half time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I guess I start thinking about what else is there, if anything, that we might be able to do to keep the current workforce engaged to the point where they aren't looking at, well, you know, if I retire, I'm going to be bringing in this, and, you know, I could mm-hmm. do a little side job doing that or whatever, and keeping them on, because it seems like one of the things that we would like to maintain is a continuity that already having people that are, and it's not to say those that come back don't have the skill sets, but there's still going to be some additional, let's say, refreshing our courses or brushing up to get them up to the point of where they're back to the level that someone that's already on the job that's been doing the job. So I was just looking to see, is there anything else that we might be able to do from our perspective or other things that the employers could be doing at the community colleges,
mm-hmm.
There at OHSU or wherever. So that's all I'm asking.
I think faculty development is probably the best thing to keep people current in what they're doing, and then also provide them, as I said, with the support systems. One of the things when budgets get cut, which they have in the last quite a few years in the state, it's many times the infrastructure, the support staff, that is also cut. And that is what we've experienced at OHSU. So what we're hoping with an increase in our budget, that we will be able to put back some of those positions that we've had to cut, and that will support the goal is then to support the faculty so that they're able to do their job easier, mm-hmm. therefore not wanting to retire.
Yeah. One other thing, I'm not sure if it's in the profession or not. I know that in many cases, long-time employees are given the opportunity to do, what, lack of a better term, some type of sabbatical.
Yes.
And I wonder if there's anything like education sabbaticals where giving someone the opportunity to maybe enhance their skills at some other setting and then have a commitment that they would come back with an obligation to continue to work for X number of years to have that ability to maybe experience something a little different, apply themselves differently, and maybe enrich their ability to come back and do more.
Yeah. You want to talk to that?
Yes. Senator Brzezinski, I think you raise an interesting issue. And there are two concerns that we're talking about today. One is retention of existing faculty and experienced faculty. But another place that we can look is assisting a person who perhaps has been in clinical practice, has the educational credentials, has been in clinical practice, who may wish to take advantage of some enhanced skills through a program that you might be suggesting or Sandy Tice might be suggesting, learn to be a faculty member, but then move from clinical practice into a faculty practice. And that would be a very valuable person because mm-hmm. they have recent clinical skills. The problem there is just as Sandy has said, if they are a practicing staff nurse or a nurse practitioner, for example, the significant reduction in their income really would argue against them doing that, and yet they might be a very valuable person for that school of nursing, whether it's a baccalaureate program or associate degree program. So I think we have to weave together a set of solutions, such as teaching them how to be faculty, such as giving them time off to get those skills in trade for coming back and having some sort of a practice obligation. But we do have to recognize that that the serious reduction in salary is just is a major disincentive for them to do that.
Okay, thank you. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been trying to figure it, you know, how to make this thing work better, do something. You know, we've got a laundry list now of people who have exempted themselves because of shortages or from some reason or another out of the 1,040 hours. So, I mean, obviously there is a need in places in the state. Most of them are for the rural places of the state. So there's something getting people out of the workforce before we're ready for them to leave the workforce. So are the benefits too rich? Is that why they're leaving? You say the salary issue, retention is an issue, but on the short term, I guess, would you be interested in, if this is going to move forward, to put in a sunset in it? Because I'm anticipating there probably won't be this shortage forever. And, I mean, it seems to me that if people have an opportunity to retire and then work full-time, most everybody's going to do it. And it just seems to me like we've got a critical shortage right now in the nursing programs and of nurses. But maybe 10 or, you know, a few years from now there won't be. So it'd force a relook at it if we were to do this now. Is that something you'd be interested in the short term?
Actually, Senator Beyer, I think that's an excellent suggestion. If we could even, I'm thinking maybe a 10-year sunset, then we could, or a 5-year, whatever. But then we would be able to see, okay, how many are really coming back and taking advantage of that? Are there those that will retire right away and then double dip, so to speak? I mean, those types of things we would have to, we could monitor, and if things were getting out of control, then we could revisit that. I think that's an excellent suggestion.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I have a question. What type of nurses are eligible for PERS?
It depends on where you're at, but those that work for the county, those that work for OHSU, and the community colleges.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay.
Corrections, I believe.
Oh, correct.
And the state mental hospital.
Okay.
Yeah, and then possibly even at the local level for schools.
Yeah. See, what the advantage of the nurses that retire from OHSU, what they're doing, that they will retire with their PERS benefits, and then they have the opportunity to go work for other hospitals. So, and I know some that do that.
Yeah. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else here who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 342? I'm not seeing anyone standing up. Mr. Dempsey, we'll give you one more opportunity to come up here and be in front of us. He says no. So with that, unless we have something else we need to do today.
That's it, Mr.
No
Chair.
Committee bills?
No committee
consider?
Bills.
We'll be adjourned, and we're scheduled to meet next week, Monday at 3?
Yep, Monday at 3.
So we'll be adjourned until then. Thank you.